Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 143rd edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what in the world it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome again, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, we certainly have plenty to hash out tonight on this broadcast, including continued failed attempts to elect a speaker for the U.S. House, and the death threats one Iowa congressional member received because of it. Plus, all those Republican presidential candidates who just keep coming to the state as they did in recent days, and the stunning announcement by one of the carbon capture pipeline companies that wanted to build in Iowa, all of that. But first, we begin with Israel. As we know, President Biden traveled to Israel last week to express support for that country in its fight against Hamas. He made a major nationwide address on Thursday night asking for support and money. And as we go on the air live on this Monday night, Laura, we do not know what's going to happen in Israel.
No, we don't. But Biden's visit to Israel was very well received, according to Israeli media. The American president is actually more popular than the Israeli leader right now among Israelis. And I think that the general perception is that while President Biden is very supportive of Israel, he is also has been encouraging Israel to hold back a little bit. He mentioned repeatedly that in both his addresses to the people of Israel and also to the American people, that we made some mistakes after 9/11 and that Israel should try to avoid acting out of emotion and rage and making similar mistakes.
Even Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley praised the president for what he called a very strong speech last week.
Yes, we've seen Iowa Republicans have very frequently spoken out in support of Israel. I think Senator Grassley was the only one I've seen actually say something positive about President Biden during this time.
There is breaking news as we go on the air tonight, and it just came out on my cell phone from the New York Times. The Biden administration, reports the Times, believes Israel lacks achievable military goals in Gaza. Well, that's going to be a problem.
Well, yes, and I think that that was the gist of what President Biden was trying to convey to the Israelis, that a full-scale invasion of Gaza might not be the wisest course right now.
All right. Last week, Governor Reynolds and Jewish leaders in Des Moines rededicated the Holocaust Memorial, and that was a moving moment.
Yes, a reader had mentioned to me a few years ago that the Holocaust Memorial on the Iowa Capitol grounds was in deteriorating condition. So it's good to know that the state spent some money to try to restore that. And as we had mentioned on the show a few weeks ago, David Wallnerman passed away, and his son, Michael Wallnerman, was at this ceremony last week talking about how important it is to remember as the number of survivors of the Holocaust continues to dwindle.
Indeed, the governor said the purpose of the Holocaust Memorial has never been more important, in her words, and that Iowa stands unapologetically with Israel against its enemies. And she also signed a proclamation declaring this week Blue Ribbon Week.
Yes, yeah, so she lit up the state capitol in blue, one of the colors of the Israeli flag. She had immediately in the aftermath of the Hamas attacks on Israel, she ordered flags to be flown at half mast in Iowa. So she has repeatedly spoken out in favor. Like many other politicians, she has visited Israel herself, and the Republican Party and the Democratic Party for the most part, but Republican leaders who are in control in Iowa, they have been very vocal in their support of Israel.
All right, and now for a story that we've been following for weeks now, the U.S. House's attempt to replace ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy. As we said before the broadcast, you cannot make this stuff up, what happened last week and what is happening. Let's just begin this on Tuesday when the House rejected the first time Ohio's Jim Jordan as a candidate for Speaker. He lost because 20 Republican holdouts refused to vote for him. He could lose only four.
Yes. And the difference between Jim Jordan and Steve Scalise, who was he is the House Majority Leader still. And normally when this kind of thing would happen, if a speaker moves on, the next in line person would move up to the speakership. But Steve Scalise actually never put it to a vote of the full House because he sensed that he didn't have 217 votes. Jim Jordan forged ahead, even though there were a number of Republicans in the House who said they weren't inclined to vote for him. And there was really a full court press. The Fox News personality Sean Hannity was involved. There were lots of people pressuring members of Congress. And I think the general consensus is that that backfired because Jordan's supporters were expecting at most 10 House Republicans to vote against him. And instead, as you say, on that first ballot, 20 voted against him.
So on that first vote, Iowa's four GOP congressional members voted for him, but not the case on Wednesday because the House again rejected Jordan's bid. This time, 22 Republicans voted against him, and one of them, Marionette Miller Meeks of Iowa's 1st Congressional District.
Yes, there seems to have been a coordinated strategy among the Republicans who opposed Jordan that they would gradually increase with every ballot. A few more were going to join the opposition to Jordan, just to emphasize that opposition to him was growing. Marionette Miller Meeks, it was very interesting because she had told reporters on the eve of the vote, she told reporters at the U.S. Capitol that she didn't like the pressure tactics that were being used by some of Jordan's supporters and that she was troubled by that. And she also remembered that Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks of Iowa had come out in support of Steve Scalise. And I think a lot of House Republicans resented the idea that after Steve Scalise won a secret ballot of the House Republican Conference, and Jordan did not really bow out, and his supporters, many of his supporters said that they would continue to back him instead of Steve Scalise, which really is not how any of this is supposed to work.
So on Wednesday, after that vote, she did cast her ballot, by the way, for Representative Kay Granger of Texas. She received what she called credible death threats and a barrage of threatening calls after pulling her support from Jordan. And indeed, there were reports that Jordan's people were really manhandling or trying to his opposition.
And I want to put this in a broader context because in the last 6 to 8 years, we have seen that threats of violence and sometimes acts of violence, but in particular, threats of violence have become a more frequent feature of American political life. You see that if journalists who have covered politics say they have received more threats, everything from school board members to librarians to members of Congress, many members of Congress routinely have received death threats. It's mostly been on the Democratic side. But so in any case, it's very credible that I don't think that we know any results from the law enforcement investigation, but it's very credible that Representative Miller Meeks did receive those threats. And by the way, other Republicans who had voted against Trump mentioned that either they or their family had been threatened. I think somebody had to hire private security to be at his children's school. And Don Bacon of Omaha, Nebraska district, he said that his wife had slept with a loaded gun under her pillow.
Oh, boy. And then on Thursday, Jordan said he would not seek another vote and that he's going to back a plan to give the GOP's Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, the temporary speaker, additional powers. Well, hours later, he gave up on that plan, put himself up for a vote on Friday, loses this time by 25 Republican votes.
Yes. And again, Marionette Miller Meeks voted against him. I was a little surprised. See, I thought that they were going to take that out, elevate the interim speaker, Patrick McHenry. That seemed like an obvious course of action to at least get things moving again. But there were a lot of people in the House Republican Conference who were claiming that that was unconstitutional. There were some who didn't like the idea that that would allow Jim Jordan to be running things behind the scenes for the next 2 months. So that plan collapsed rather quickly, and then it's back to the drawing board.
And then later on Friday, House Republicans voted behind closed doors for Jordan to step aside as speaker nominee. That vote 112-86. And so House Republicans over the weekend, some of them announced they're going to run, and they're meeting tonight as we go on the air live here in the Midwest. They're meeting in Washington. 9 members had announced they're going to seek the speakership. 1 has pulled out, and we don't know most of them, Laura.
That's right. And I wanted to emphasize, you said the vote, 112-86. This was a secret ballot behind closed doors. 112 House Republicans voted for Jim Jordan to step aside as the speaker designee, but only 25 of them had the guts to vote against him on the floor. And that tells you something about the state of the Republican Party, that a lot of people don't want to publicly oppose Donald Trump's preferred candidate, Fox News' preferred candidate, Jim Jordan.
Right. So of the 8 candidates who are meeting tonight at the Capitol, as we go on the air, 7 of them are election deniers. All right. Well, 6, at least 6 of the 8 are election deniers. 7 of the 9 were. That's quite a, how do we want to put this? Quite a statement on the state of our democracy that the people who may become the next speaker do not realize that Donald Trump lost the election.
Remember that 2/3 of the Republican conference basically voted not to accept the results of the 2020 election. So really a lot of Republicans did vote. And the two that Tom Emmer, who is the current House Majority Whip, and Austin Scott of Georgia are the two who didn't vote to, again, certifying those election results. But they had previously signed on to a lawsuit, a Texas, there was an amicus brief and a Texas lawsuit that would have asked the Supreme Court to overturn the election. That was not successful. But so in a sense, you could argue that all of them had in one way or another tried to express their support for overturning the results of the 2020 election. So again, it really tells you something about the state of the Republican Party.
So let's summarize all of this on this Monday night. As of this hour, we have no House Speaker. Are we going to have one next Monday night at this hour? I have no clue.
I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to see a path for 217 votes. And one of the issues, I mean, there are a number of things that have contributed to this. First of all, gerrymandering, because so many members of Congress are in safe seats. Most of the House Republicans are in no danger of losing a general election. They're in much greater danger of losing a Republican primary if they don't do the right thing. So that's why you see many of them taking rather uncompromising positions. Also, the legislative work of Congress is not as important to a lot of these people as it used to be, because they can go on TV, they can go on podcasts, they can raise money independently through social media platforms. So they don't need, I mean, in the past, you would never have had backbenchers in the conference not voting for the leader to become speaker, because they would have lost their committee assignments. The leadership would have shut down any bills they wanted to run, any amendments they wanted to run. But that's not really what it's about now for a lot of the people who serve in Congress.
Yes. All right. Well, as I said off the top, you cannot make this stuff up. This is actually happening. We'll find out what did happen next Monday night. Let's move on to the Capitol Week Caucus Almanac. I can't hear our theme song, but I'm sure we have one. Got it. So many things happened over the weekend here. Candidates were here. We're going to try to summarize it quickly and succinctly, but in an order. First of all, the latest news is Senator Tim Scott is the latest candidate to decide Iowa's it. This is it. Do or die. His campaign announced today he's shifting his resources to Iowa for the caucuses.
I mean, this is a tried and true strategy, right? Going back to even in the 2008 cycle, I remember some of the candidates pinning it all on Iowa, and it didn't work for Chris Dodd, the Democrat, but it did work pretty well for Mike Huckabee, the Republican, at least in terms of winning the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, this dynamic, as we've discussed, it's very different. This is really not an open field. This is Trump running as the de facto incumbent, and everybody else is failing to gain traction. And so Tim Scott is the latest one to say, we're going to make our stand in Iowa, but I just don't see any sign that enough of the voters, especially the evangelical Christian voters, that seems to be the focus of Tim Scott's outreach, most of them are either supporting Trump or at least content with Trump.
Yeah, I was about to say that. I do. He believes he has an opening with evangelicals. I do not see it at this point, and the polls do not show it. So I'm wondering what the magic is that they see.
I don't know that they necessarily do see it, right? We talked about how the super PAC that is aligned with Tim Scott pulled a lot of its advertising. I think that their internal polling is showing the same thing that a lot of the public polling is showing, that right now the Republican electorate is not looking for an alternative to Donald Trump.
All right, let's summarize this before we get into what happened over the weekend with Marionette Miller Meeks. Real Clear Politics, a rolling average of recent Iowa polling shows Trump at 50%, DeSantis 17, Haley 9.5, Ramaswamy and Scott 6. So we know what's happening there. She holds this big gathering on Friday night, her third annual Triple M tailgate. 7 presidential candidates showed up, most of them focusing on the Israel-Hamas conflict. Let's start with Tim Scott.
That's right. I just wanted to say quickly that it was a little bit controversial. Some members of Congress thought that they should stay in Washington and work all weekend until they have a speaker. But a lot of people had things they wanted to do back in their districts. This is an event Marionette Miller Meeks had been planning for a long time. So, yes, she had many presidential candidates. Tim Scott, this is a new thing now in the Republican field, where he's talking about how he would take away Pell Grants from universities that allow protests in support of Palestinians. I mean, I'm pretty sure that kind of a policy wouldn't hold up in court. It would be a violation of the First Amendment free speech and free assembly rights. But in any case, this is something that we've heard. This seems to be an idea that is gaining traction in Republican circles.
Ron DeSantis repeated his calls to deny Palestinian refugees entry into the U.S. Nikki Haley said the biggest threat to the U.S. is Iran, the country she said is funding Hamas. And it sort of went down the way. This is the way Republican presidential candidates are campaigning right now. We're talking about Israel. We're talking about students, Palestinians.
Yes. And I think that compared to past campaigns, we're hearing a lot more about foreign policy in this campaign than is normal in a presidential cycle. But a lot of times it's a foreign policy argument with a domestic, there is a kind of domestic spin to it. So, and we've seen Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley have been really fighting their, Nikki Haley in some polls is maybe even challenging him for second place. And so they've been attacking each other more than they've been attacking the front runner.
Vivek Ramaswamy started by complimenting DeSantis for his decision to charter emergency flights from Israel to help U.S. citizens who are fleeing the conflict. But then he said an interesting thing, at least to me. He said, I do not believe it's going to be good for Israel, and I do not believe it's going to be good for the U.S. He was talking about that potentially imminent ground invasion of Gaza.
Yes, and I mean, we've seen this from what I've read, at least in the English language media reports out of Israel. I mean, there is a debate even within Israel. I mean, it's the population is not unified in support of a full-scale ground invasion of Gaza. And there are real questions about whether that would achieve a long-term strategic objective of Israel or not. But Vivek Ramaswamy, I think before any of this blew up, he has always tried to take a slightly different tact. He talked about in the last debate how he knows the prime minister of Israel and that he would be able to speak very frankly with him. And he has taken, isolationist might be going a bit too far, but he has taken more of an isolationist position on some foreign policy issues than some of the other presidential candidates.
Meanwhile, Doug Burgum, Asa Hutchinson, and Ryan Binkley, who were all there in Iowa City on Friday night, didn't really have much to say that anybody reported because they are really also RANs. Perry Johnson was going to be there, but he suspended his presidential bid just before he got there. And today he endorsed Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise. If you listen to anything, any speech by Perry Johnson, he had a very Trump-like energy, and he never said anything to set himself up as an alternative to Trump. So I always felt like his campaign was more like auditioning for a cabinet position in the next Trump administration.
Grinnell College put out a poll last week. It shows that Biden and Trump are in a dead heat, 40% each among likely voters nationwide. Now, why should we care about Grinnell College? Well, because this poll was conducted in collaboration with Ann Seltzer, who also runs the highly respected Des Moines Register Iowa poll.
Yes, she did. And I've seen there's been some other national polling that has shown something similar, that Biden and Trump are basically tied or within the margin of error. And one thing that the Grinnell College poll showed, and it's showing up in other surveys as well, is a relatively high percentage of people claiming that they would support a third party candidate. In this poll, it was 18% said they would support someone else. Something that you need to know about presidential polling that's been true for 40 years at least is that polls always overstate support for third party candidates. A poll respondent often will say that they would support someone else. That's just a way of expressing their dissatisfaction with the major party nominees. But in, let's take the 2016 election, which had, by historical standards, a pretty high percentage of people voting for third party candidates because Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were both relatively unpopular. The combined vote for all of the third party candidates was about 5% nationally. So there is no way Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West are going to be combining to get 15% or 18%, as was the result of this Grinnell College poll. But it does show that it again is another sign that a lot of people are not happy with what's likely to be on offer next November.
And one more note on this, the Washington Post writer Philip Bump, who is an absolute guru, and I really mean this, when it comes to statistics and graphs, he's the guy to read, says in a piece that's going to be printed tomorrow that it is hard to imagine, I'm quoting, a scenario in which Donald Trump sees a sudden erosion in support large enough to cost him in the lead. You and I have been saying this for a while now. I just don't see an avenue for anybody else. Do you?
No, I mean, I don't know. I question whether it was ever there. But a year ago, you could say, well, Donald Trump looks like the favorite, but who knows what's going to happen? He could be criminally indicted or lots of other things could happen. And now we've seen four separate indictments. And if anything, his position relative to the rest of the field has strengthened, not weakened. So it seems like there was a window shortly after the 2022 midterms where there was a perception that the Republican Party underperformed, and some people felt maybe it was time to move on from Donald Trump. But I think that perception sort of drifted away. Trump has said that the reason it was related to abortion and maybe some other issues. And so within the Republican base, the primary electorate, there is just not a sign. I mean, they don't see Trump as a loser. Many of them don't believe that he lost the last election, and many of them believe that he would win the next election.
It is 19 minutes and 30 seconds exactly after the hour, 19 and a half after the hour, and this is KHOS Capital Week with Laura Bell and me, Dennis Hart. We are your one-stop source for everything politically going on in Iowa, and we do it with a high degree of efficiency, I might add. We are here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. I got a smile out of you, Laura. This is good. Now we want to spend some serious time about what happened last week with the carbon capture pipeline projects, because it was a very, very big deal. I'll give the headline, you give the details. Navigator CO2 Ventures said it was killing its proposed $3.5 billion capture pipeline project that was slated to run across Iowa and four states. That's a wowser.
It really is. Last week was just the biggest news week related to the carbon dioxide pipelines that we've had in months. And we've covered this. You know, there have been a lot of weeks where we talked about it on the show. There have been weeks we didn't quite get to it. And I always said, well, we'll have a chance to circle back later. But this was a really big one. Navigator, one of the three companies that was seeking a permit to build a CO2 pipeline across Iowa. They ran into trouble. Their permit application was denied in South Dakota. They had withdrawn their application in Illinois. And eventually they just said that the regulatory environment was just too unpredictable and they're not moving forward with their attempt to build this thing.
Navigator had reached an agreement with POET, and that's the world's biggest ethanol producer, to capture carbon dioxide emissions from 18 of its plants in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. As we say, it's one of three projects, now one of two projects left. And this one, to me, came out of left field. Yes, South Dakota regulators had denied a permit, and Navigator had twice pulled its permit application to Illinois, but this was still a surprise.
I think for the people who are following it closely, and I'm in contact with some people who are keeping a very close eye on the Iowa Utility Board's evidentiary hearing related to the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline, they weren't very surprised that Navigator pulled out. I think the perception has been that Summit was more likely to gain regulatory approval and that Navigator's bid was in real trouble. There's a lot we don't know about the finances of this, but it could be that it just to try to put something together and with delays that would come in the process, it wasn't ever going to work. So now, I mean, one of the things that people are speculating about now is, will POET sign an agreement with Summit Carbon Solutions? POET, as you mentioned, they have 18 ethanol plants, but I believe 12 of them are in Iowa. And Summit Carbon Solutions was working with 13 ethanol plants in Iowa. So that could dramatically increase the size and scope of the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline.
Speaking of Summit, we call this a segue in broadcasting. Earlier last week, Summit said it was pushing back its timeline 2 years to the year 2026 to start operating its proposed $5.5 billion pipeline. Another big deal.
Yes. Well, they really had no choice because so far the regulators in North and South Dakota have not approved their permit applications. I think most people expect that the permit application in Iowa is going to be approved. Governor Kim Reynolds has appointed all three members of the Iowa Utilities Board. She is very close to Bruce Rastetter, who is the leader of the Summit Ag Group, which is affiliated with the Summit Carbon Solutions. That's his baby. And I think that many people perceive that if any of these things gets the go-ahead, it is going to be Summit Carbon Solutions. But again, we have weeks to go still before the Iowa Utilities Board even wraps up its hearing, let alone issue a decision.
So I know, Laura, our listeners are probably saying, well, you guys have wrapped this one up. No, we have not. We always want surprises in this broadcast. There's more to talk about, including Iowans filing a lawsuit challenging a water use permit the DNR issued to one of the LLCs linked to, guess who, Summit.
Yeah, so there were two other stories last week that really got overshadowed by the Navigator announcement and the Summit announcement of their delay. And one of them was this lawsuit. So there are three women, Iowans, who get water from one of the aquifers that would be tapped by a company that is linked to Summit Carbon Solutions. It's complicated, but I'm going to try to simplify it. Summit Carbon has created or has affiliated a lot of small LLCs, and these individual LLCs are located next to the various ethanol plants that are partners on the Summit Pipeline Project. And each of these LLCs several of them have already, and the others presumably will be seeking water use permits for the carbon capture facilities. For this whole pipeline to work, they need to have facilities that are going to capture the CO2 from the ethanol plants and convert it. And that is a process that's going to require a lot of water. But instead of the overall company, Summit Carbon Solutions, filing all these water use permits, they've got all these little LLCs that have no employees or anything that are filing for the permit. So one of these permits was granted several months ago. And this lawsuit that was filed, it's actually a lawsuit against the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. It's seeking to vacate the permit. And it's important because without these facilities to gain access to the water, they aren't going to be able to even do the carbon capture that would allow these pipelines to happen. So we'll see where this lawsuit goes and where some of the other permit applications go. But that is potentially a very big development.
And very quickly, one more note on carbon capture pipelines. State Utilities Board made a decision about Hardin County.
Yes. So this is another example of why many observers think that the Iowa Utilities Board is going to approve Summit's application. Hardin County, which is one of the counties on the proposed route for Summit Carbon Solutions, they had filed a motion with the Utilities Board to say, hey, we want you to declare that these carbon capture facilities, the ones next to the ethanol plants, the ones that would actually be converting the excess CO2 from the ethanol plants, we want you to declare that this is not something that you can regulate because this is not a hazardous liquid pipeline. And if they had succeeded with that motion, that would have meant that local authorities, city or county governments could have regulated, they could have used zonings, rules, they could have used other permitting rules to try to shut down these carbon capture facilities. And the Iowa Utilities Board basically said, no, that's not going to be successful. So that is a door that appears to be, at least for now, that's a door that's closed to people trying to prevent Summit Carbon Solutions from building this pipeline.
And that is your carbon capture pipeline update for this Monday night. Now let's move on to elections very quickly, about 3.5 minutes. A Democrat from Cedar Falls, Sarah Corkery, became the first Democrat to jump into the race to challenge GOP incumbent 2nd Congressional District member Ashley Hinson. Okay, Sarah Corkery, how serious is this candidacy going to be?
Well, first of all, I mean, one thing that was unusual about this announcement was that Ashley Hinson's campaign actually beat Sarah Corkery to the punch before Sarah Corkery had filed papers with the Federal Election Commission, before she had announced on social media, or before she had even put up her campaign Facebook page. The Hinson campaign was out with a very aggressive press release saying, you know, that she's a far leftist and she voted for Biden and all of this. So that was kind of surprising to me. I mean, Ashley Hinson, the 2nd Congressional District, is not considered one of the ones that's likely to be particularly competitive. And in some cases, the incumbent would take more the position of not acknowledging the opponent, but Ashley Hinson's campaign has come out pretty strongly. Sarah Corkery, first-time candidate, never run for office before, not someone who's been a very well-known in Iowa Democratic politics, but I talked to her late last week, and she said that she's really looking forward to the race. I mean, one of the reasons that she ran is she's a 2-time breast cancer survivor, and she's been trying to encourage Ashley Hinson to sign on to a bill that it would be related to people who have metastatic breast cancer, and the entire rest of the Iowa congressional delegation had already agreed to co-sponsor this bill, but Ashley Hinson turned them down more than once. And so that was, she said she wants to raise awareness about this issue. There are other issues where she feels that Ashley Hinson's voting record doesn't really reflect what would be good for the district, everything from infrastructure to mental health services. And she said, when I asked her, I said, well, this looks like this is not going to be targeted by the National House Democrats. And she said, I'm looking forward to being an independent voice and doing this on my own. And she's not planning to run a traditional campaign. She clearly is probably not going to be able to raise the kind of money that candidates can raise in a targeted race. But she said that she's very much looking forward to it.
Ashley Hinson reported raising more than $740,000 from July through September, and she has $1.3 million in the bank. Money is the mother's milk of politics, as one of our politicians out here in California said. And Ashley Hinson, she's got the money.
And Ashley Hinson has always been a strong fundraiser. I will say that her campaign does tend to have a pretty high burn rate. They spend a lot of what they raise, but she benefited in last year's campaign where the Democratic nominee was Liz Mathis, who also raised quite a lot of money. But Liz Mathis did not get the help from the national groups, whereas the National Republican Congressional Committee and other Republican-aligned groups came in and spent pretty heavily for Ashley Hinson and against Liz Mathis. Ashley Hinson is considered a rising star. She has a seat on the Appropriations Committee in the House. She was tapped to give one of the speeches defending Kevin McCarthy before he was ousted. So the national Republicans are going to do whatever they need to do and spend whatever they need to spend to defend this seat.
Laura, it's been a busy night, a hectic night. We have 15 seconds left. I think we're both going to be watching the House Speaker's race this week, aren't we?
Oh, I've really been glued to all of the roll call votes, and I've been reading a lot of the people. I mean, it's just astounding what's happening. It's something, it's like, to say that it's unprecedented is an understatement, because it is so astonishing.
I'll say it one more time. You cannot make this stuff up. That is it. We're out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I are going to be back here in the same time slot next week. And as usual, we're going to talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in Iowa politics. A lot of that. And as always, we hope you can join us. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very happy week.